It was hard, but at the same time, the fundraising process really forced us to make some really good product decisions that helped us a lot. And I'm really grateful to all of the investors who spoke to us during that period of time, because all of their feedback really helped and listening to them was helpful.
Is everything over? Shall we give up on the gaming industry now? Shall we stop trying making games, building studios and companies that have the power to positively impact the future lives of millions of players, professional and humans? No, we don't. In this special track of Rise and Play, I will be focusing on the unspoken topics around building game companies, founders teams, fundraising, pitching, rebouncing after closing your studio company or losing your job. By bringing guests who are going through the same storm of 2024 like you, and keep fighting. I will also share openly my own process, trials and error, and step-by-step building the new game company Killen as the first-time CEO of a game company. I believe we are stronger together, and we don't have to go through the storm alone, because at Rise and Play, we are not alone. Oh, and one last thing. As you feel supercharged by listening to this episode, it will mean a lot to me, and if you haven't done it yet, that you hit the follow button. It will help with the discovery of the show so other people can benefit from the content too. Thanks. And now, let's get to the episode. So, hi everyone. Here we have, I think this is the maximum I get in my podcast for people. I tried with three in the past, even Johanna was part of it, but we are four. And in this special series, I wanted to tackle quite an unspoken topic about fundraising, the difficulty of fundraising, because usually when you hear about fundraising these days, I have that game investor log on Telegram that tells me about all the companies that receive 5 to 10 million per day. And that's the stories we celebrate. We just don't know how they get there. But there's also the real warrior journey of fundraising for the ones who manage, for the ones who are doing it, have been doing it like myself. And I'm grateful that I've actually learned a lot from Aurora, Johanna, and Julia through my own journey. And we're here to tackle the topic here about what you can learn and should know before or while you're fundraising in 2024. So welcome, everyone. And maybe let's start with a quick round of intro for the context of our listeners today who have missed some of your episodes, because we have had a few episodes with Johanna. And also with Julia, not yet with you, Aurora, but that will come soon. And let's start with you, Julia, if you don't mind.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm Julia Palatowska. I'm a co-founder and CEO of Dorian. Dorian is a two-sided marketplace where on one side we've got content creators and on the other side, their fans. It is a very ambitious project. Our ambition is to enable such large content creator classes as artists and writers to turn their content into games. It's an extremely exciting journey so far. We achieved over 7,500 published creators on the platform. So all of these creators are typically amateurs who potentially have been making some content for a while, but never really monetized it. And what we're really good at is unlocking free-to-play game monetization for them. The biggest pride for me and a big part of our mission is that we bring people who have not been able to make games before, who have been outside of this industry and could not enter the industry easily. Namely, around 90% of people who make games on Dorian are women and non-binary people. And because people can take risks, because they have democratized tools, they have very original ideas, we see them trying something that professionals and studios would never try. And some of them have already built cult followings. So far, we have raised 19 million. And we hit our fast early growth this year. We have been doubling our revenue for the third month in a row, which is very exciting. All generated by amateur content, literally all of it.
Awesome. Aurora?
Yeah. So my name is Aurora Klebelberg. I started my gaming career 11 years ago as part of the Norwegian game company Dirtybit. In 2015, I moved to San Francisco to start my own company, and we built an SDK for mobile games and raised $1.6 million over two rounds, and was later acquired by Metal.tv in 2019. I then served as Metal's COO for 4 years, and we raised over $60 million and acquired four more companies during that phase. I'm also on a board of a cosplay community platform called Cosgear, and now taken a year-long sabbatical and are ready for something new that I can't really talk about yet. But for the context of this conversation, I should also share that I've written a few angel checks, and I've also been helping a few companies raise their own funding in the past year. So what I'm speaking to is based both across my own journey of fundraising as well as seeing other people go through their fundraise.
Very nice. Last but not least, Ioana.
Hey, so I'm Ioana Hreninchuk. I've co-founded a startup called still publicly PickFinder right now, but being reborn very soon as Runware, probably by the time that this podcast is out. So it's an AI infrastructure startup that was inspired by some of the work I was doing in gaming. So before the startup, I was the chief product officer of Homa Games. And before that, I was the CEO of Game Analytics. So more of a platform kind of product person in gaming. And that really inspired kind of the approach for the AI infrastructure startup. So we wanted to build a visual AI platform for product developers. So for people to actually integrate visual AI into their products, Stable Diffusion, and to be able to do it at scale, at a scale of like millions of users, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of images, and to be able to do it both in real time and affordably. So the benefits of our AI infrastructure platform is it's the fastest, most cost-efficient platform for integrating Stable Diffusion into your product. In order to do this, I raised $3 million. So the first like $500K came from Speedrun, the Andreessen Horowitz accelerator that I think is probably very relevant for people in gaming because it is a gaming accelerator. And I'm happy to talk about that. And I do coach founders on how to get into Speedrun. And secondly, we raised, after pivoting, a very oversubscribed pre-seed round. And I could really talk about the difference between like hearing no after no and then ultimately being successful with fundraising. Yeah.
Very nice. So you, the three of you have really relevant experience. So let's start with my first question about hope versus reality. So I'd like to hear, starting from maybe Aurora, if you'd like, what were the hopes when you fundraised, you know, your dream, and how they were crushed in the reality, and that, you know, like, especially looking back now, because it's been indeed a few years now.
Yeah. So we naively thought fundraising would be a breeze. In the fall of 20, we decided what our company would do, and we talked to a few investors that were asking for meetings with us, and everyone was like, oh, when can we invest, was like the mantra. But we had learned that we shouldn't fundraise until we were ready. And so our plan was to start in January 2016, closed around in March, April of 2016, and take it from there. We were planning on raising $1.5 million at a $6 million pre-safe because we estimated that we needed $1.5 million. That was a 20% dilution on the seed round at that point. So that was like the mechanics behind it. However, we also didn't want to spend unnecessary time fundraising. So we prioritized product as opposed to preparing a pitch deck, for instance. And so we actually showed up to our dream VC, presented our pitch, like in terms of describing the product, describing our traction and all of that, only to be pierced with questions regarding our business model, things that we hadn't thought about at that point, because we thought that, well, at this point, they're investing in the team anyways, and of course, we'll figure these things out. But like, we wouldn't have those answers just yet. And so we really felt crushed. And we then shifted to starting to ask for advice instead of money, even though we were running out of money. We spent the first full year running through our own savings, as some context. But after going through a lot of back and forth, we were able to secure first $200,000 in sweat equity from a Norwegian fund that was also based in the Bay Area. And then later, $300,000 from a Norwegian investor. And the irony is not lost on me, the fact that we moved from Norway to the US, set up a US company, and then ended up raising from Norwegian VCs. So we were, all in all, the first year in 2016, we raised 600,000, which gave us some time to get some consultants to help us get the platform out of alpha. And then in the spring of 2017, we had again struggled fundraising. We had approached six of our most promising game investor leads that winter and ended up in diligence with two of them, but we still didn't have the answers that they needed. To share a bit more, we were building a B2B product and the sales cycle was so long that we didn't get the information they needed to feel that we could compete long-term in the market we were going for, which was a new market. So during GDC 2017, we pivoted to only focus on selling the product and not fundraising anymore. A few weeks after we had landed a larger games company, and the CEO actually reached out to me and said this was the first time his developers were excited to implement an SDK, and they really liked the SDK, and he wanted to see if we wanted to join forces. And so the acquisition probe gave us the momentum we needed to actually go back to our own investors and have them to have them invest even more. And from their perspective, they were like, well, this is the sign we need to see that you're on the right path. And so we actually raised $1 million more, which gave us additional 18 months, actually, but it turned out to be 2 years of runway. And we grew the team to seven people during that time. So it was like almost 2 years of sweat and tears and running out of money a few times before it worked for us.
So just as for a question, so with a hope, were you expecting that, like that journey of sweat? And no?
Not at all. Not at all. Naively, I thought this would be a walk in the park, given we had such huge success from our time at Fun Run. But the reality was that when we like crossed the pond to come over to the States, like no one cared.
Well, thanks for sharing. Julia, how was your journey?
It's been a lot of fun. But I did have these expectations that it wouldn't be an easy journey. In our case, I think so. We raised three rounds. The first round was pre-seed, 2 million. The second one was seed, 3 million. And the third one was Series A, 14. Each round was very different. So in our case, our first round was actually fairly easy. The only thing that I want to share as a learning was that as someone who used to be in Europe and then moved to the Bay Area, just like Aurora, I had this preconceived notion that rounds are supposed to be led by a lead investor. This is a more European concept. And that was the biggest learning for me raising in the West Coast, because in our case, what helped was that we got offers and commitment from several fantastic angels. It was less than what we hoped for. We wanted to raise around 2 million, but then the angel commitments were like accumulating to about 500,000. And then we thought, okay, we will just take angel checks and we will run with this. And then once I said to some of our investors that we are just wrapping up the round of just angel commitments, we got a lead investor who stepped in. It was still not a hard process. I felt it was still pretty fast for us to raise that first round. The second round that we raised was much harder. We were raising after the pandemic started. We had to change a lot. We had to pivot in terms of how we thought about the immediate priorities, because we basically had something that we wanted to do later, and we had to do that much quicker from technology and product priority standpoint. Our engineers worked overtime, and we did some phenomenal work on our engine side to enable creators to do much more than we initially thought would be enough successful to fundraise. During that period of time, I felt like we needed to iterate a lot. And I took this iterative view. It's okay if your pitches do not go as well as you imagined. Just keep iterating. We probably had over 100 iterations of our pitch deck in that round. And since then, I feel it like, okay, like you need to start talking to people. You see the feedback of people who do not know your business, who you need to simplify your business for, because you have so much information in your head. And each iteration usually is a simplification of your view, especially at earlier stages, right? Because you still need to sell the vision rather than the traction, because it was a seed round. That was hard, but at the same time, the fundraising process really forced us to make some really good product decisions that helped us a lot. And I'm really grateful to all of the investors who spoke to us during that period of time, because all of their feedback really helped, and like listening to them was helpful. And then our Series A was raised on early traction. We had what most of our investors really liked during Series A. It was a much better market. It was an easier process. What investors liked was that there was a great path to monetization. We had quite a few creators who had started monetizing before that. Our investors were impressed that it's UGC monetizing from fan spend, right? Which is very unusual, because majority of the UGC platforms are just not monetizing from fans, whatever it is. It doesn't have to be only game platforms. Majority of UGC platforms are really not monetizing from fan spend. So this early monetization pass was very convincing. We also had some really great deals with partners. We had a partnership with Lionsgate for Blair Witch and AMC for Interview with the Vampire. So we had quite a bit to show. So all three rounds were different. Now we are not actively fundraising yet, but we see some interest. And I hope our Series B will be on our great unit economics.
Thanks. And alas, Joanna, what was your experience much more recent?
So we were fundraising last year, which was a terrible year to fundraise, really bad. And also the reason, so expectations versus reality is nobody really tells you the truth. So just, I really think that like, it just takes you for me, like it takes a few 3 months to just realize what the reality is. Yeah, and in my experience, the reality is, do you already have a successful exit? If yes, you are very likely to fundraise. You just need a reasonable idea. If you have a successful exit before, you will fundraise. If you don't have a successful exit, did you have a really big job making a lot of money for a company that makes people believe that you will do that again? And if you didn't have that, then it's tough. Then you really need an idea that is super convincing with early signs of traction. It doesn't matter that you're like pre-seed, before product market fit, like, and people are going to want that from you, because really they don't have anything else to go off of. So I think one of the things people who are successful at fundraising don't know this, but people who are not don't really understand the value of you as a founder and how much building towards eventually starting a company is a process. If you have the aspiration to be a founder in 5 years or 10 years, like this is the time to start building yourself as an investable founder is now. Mm. Secondly, VCs kind of are just as optimistic as founders are. They will tell you are amazing and then they will ghost you. Like, and finally, the best predictor is, if somebody's already signed the check, and this is where like Julia's pointed, like it's not really about doing the party round. It's really hard to get somebody to commit to a big check if you don't really have either super strong traction or super strong background. So if that's the case, you need to get people to commit to smaller checks, get to a good amount that builds enough belief. For us, exactly. The moment people started to sign checks, it was like the moment we had like a big investor, and actually that could kind of be presented as a lead, the round became immediately oversubscribed. Like we went from zero to people fighting to give us money. The sign of other investors thinking you're hot is the old, like, is like such a hot currency, and you kind of being able to create the sense that people think your startup is hot is really important. So it's much more like high school than you'd believe. And the other thing that I would add is, for me going through this journey, it's the other founders that really kept me going. Because you think on LinkedIn, you only see the people who are succeeding. You only see the rounds. And like 98% of the people are at home getting their, like, you know, 10th no of the week. And they're just as depressed as you are. Like, so, and I think it's important to be honest, like, as founders about that. Because for me, realizing that we're all kind of failing every week, but succeeding longer term, like, on every given week, we're failing, but like over 6 months, a lot of us are succeeding. That really kept me going, and that really gave me fuel and the candidness of other founders admitting that they were feeling the same way. So yeah, it's very confusing and it feels like a very lonely journey, but the other founders really make it worthwhile. And finally, and final point is, your co-founder is also super important. Like for me and my co-founder, he, like, the company was kind of built around his vision. He's extremely technically strong. He has a really unique vision. But let's say I had the better resume on paper as well, right? So we needed to really manage that and how we speak. And we really needed to adapt together and going through the process. So you're also going to need to change a lot as a team from the fundraising process. And it's really the first test of you as a founding team. And if you can't make it for that, it is better to break up, because you're not going to make it. You know, it's very hard. They really matter a lot.
Yeah. Thanks for the candid feedback and experience. Let's cover one more question, more for a round or whoever relates the most to it. Because I asked myself about, you receive so much feedback on your pitch and on, you know, what's missing in your business, and you have a bit of a projection of your VCs based on their thesis, you know, what they would like to see. How have you navigated that, where sometimes you really need to take the feedback to heart and you pivot your business, your what you thought you would do, and some other times like, thanks for the feedback, but no, I'm not compromising on my vision and I do this. And then if that means I get all no's, I'll stick to it. So who would like to start sharing their experience?
I can share some of ours, especially in the first round. Everyone who committed and invested in our company, I could tell the moment when they made the decision to invest. It was like this kind of like eyes lighting up. And I felt like everyone invested based on something different. And it's very important to remember this when you're presenting, because people just perceive, have different perspectives. That's very normal. We had some situations when I had feedback on our pitch, and on the very same day, the feedback was absolutely different from, like, you know, from totally, like, totally different perspectives. Like, I'm gonna invest because of X, or like, no, I will not invest and you will not fundraise because of X. So it was interesting. You have to have potentially different angle for different people. Obviously, you have your story, you have your validation, you have your team, because someone reacts to the team, someone reacts to some numbers, someone reacts to longer term vision, someone reacts to your tenacity as a founder. So I would recommend not to look at investors as these demanding overlords that are trying to, like, harm you or just unreasonable or something. They are also humans. They are oftentimes very creative. They have their opinions. And that's normal. That's fun. That's part of life, to interact with them and learn from each other. So that's how I see it.
So I wanted to add a couple of points. I wanted to mention that US and European investors are also very different. So US investors are much more big vision. Like, you have to want to go there. You have to articulate a super solid vision. European investor is much more about, what are your numbers today? What are your costs? Show me a business plan. I swear to God, no US investor has asked me for, like, a business plan until we were late in the process. Like, Europeans are risk averse versus like, US investors tend to be very much big picture orientated, big vision, want to win. So also, you'll get a lot of conflicting feedback from these two perspectives. And you could even have two pitch decks for this if you want. But my advice is to really take the feedback of the investors you want to have. So, like, in any way, there's, like, top shelf investors that everybody wants. You know, everybody wants the LVPs, but also, like, the Sequoias, the Andreessens, the XLs, like, everybody wants these guys. And then there's also, but there's more specialized funds that are probably better at understanding what, not just better understanding what you actually do. They're more used to, they're willing to give you more time as a founders. And then there's angels and micro funds and so on. You really want to be speaking to investors, first of all, before you're ready. You kind of want to start putting it out there. I'm going to fundraise. You kind of want to start getting to know them and setting the calls. You want to form an impression about what they like, and you want to read the blogs of the big guys. Like the top shelf investors put out their vision for the market, and kind of their market tends to adapt because they have the most resources to assess the market. So you'll see a lot of micro funds, angels are very influenced by this stuff. So you kind of really want to segment the market this way. You want to kind of group it geographically. You want to kind of really speak to them in this order and start to form an impression, really adopt the lingo, and then make a pitch on the basis of this. So initially, you want to have some sort of pitch, like don't have nothing, but you want to kind of really build up towards your fundraise that aligns with momentum that you have in the business. I made this release and I have my first customers and the traction is great. And I've been speaking to you for 6 months and now I'm fundraising, right? So you kind of want to do these things. And when during the 6 months process, you can take feedback. But again, you want to start to figure out, actually, I want to raise from specialist investors because my product is really niche and I need them to invest. And if I get some general purpose investors, fine. But these are, for instance, we found a lot more success with more deeper tech investors because we could really connect on hardware, AI infrastructure, and so on. And with like regular B2B investors, it was very hard to have those conversations and they kind of didn't really know what bucket to put us in. And some were interested, but it was really getting a deep tech investor on board that helped to solidify the confidence for them. So just keep in mind, there's those differences as well in how you take the feedback and when you take it and when you can apply it so you can align with this fundraising momentum.
Yeah, for me, like I've seen this through different lenses throughout. And building on what Julia said, I think we should always try to educate our investors as well. As an investor, you don't necessarily want to go in the room and leave with no new knowledge, right? Like there's a huge opportunity for you as a founder to establish yourself as a thought leader, right? Because if you're really going to make a dent in whatever you're going to do, you need to come with something new. And a lot of times that goes through education. And so even though that the investor may not agree with your stance, like if you receive that feedback with integrity, like you can still try and prove them wrong and like keep them in the loop as you learn new things. And if you end up learning something new, like that is also a good opportunity to show vulnerability, but still like tenacity and rigor, right? As you proceed on your journey. And so in my experience, like persistence in this conversation is really important. Like if you have strong conviction, you're also being tested, right? Like don't take all the feedback as as a sign that the investor did not believe in you. It's also an opportunity for them to test like how strong is your conviction, right? But do all of this with integrity. And if there's one thing that Pim DeVitt, who's the CEO in Metal, was just absolutely amazing at, was to always start each meeting with a fresh start. Like he would never let the prior no or VC conversation get to his head as we entered a new conversation. And I just thought that was very remarkable. And I always try and advise everyone else at doing that. But I think to like close this one out, like don't take no as a final no. There's always an opportunity to come back. And that is just like, no one follows up, like literally, right? So there's always an opportunity for you to stand out by doing that and continue to show conviction and rigor.
I would like to add to this because we turned multiple no's into a yes, because thanks to just continuing pitching. So we did it multiple times. So I kind of almost expect that it's part of the process. And there was one conversation that I remember was over Zoom. And it was an investor who it seemed like they were not inclined to invest in us. They demonstrated some doubt. And I said, you know what, like, you might not want to invest in us. That's fine. I understand. But I will take my opportunity to evangelize for our company at this time. So let me explain what we're doing, why we're doing this. And eventually they signed a very big check. That was a great partnership eventually.
So a lot of learning packed in all your experience, which are quite complementary at different time, different companies, but also different experience. And for the listeners, there's so much to learn. So please, for the listeners, take note, because yeah, those are valuable insights where you can save 6 months or a year of your life in stress, not having to go through this, but you make new mistakes. So let's close the round with some rapid fire questions, more so out of curiosity for me, because I've heard it's important to create FOMO. Do you agree?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. How do you create FOMO, if someone can just say that quickly?
So incentivize early commitments, like give discounts, come in at lower cap, like do anything to make it more entice it to come on early.
Yeah, get 2-3 commitments in a row, like, and use those and communicate those. Oh, we got this, we got this, we got this. Like, make sure people know you're succeeding, and then that sense is created. And also concentrate your fundraising with peaks and valleys.
Yeah. Fundraising is like Tinder dating. That's like, it's a process of matchmaking in that sense that you don't know who fits you. And the ones you thought are fitting you are not the ones that fitting you, and the ones that you didn't think were fitting you are fitting you. True or not?
I think it's true. You need to get to know people just like in any relationship.
I think it's like match.com, where you should be prepared with like, do we have the same interests before, and be able to talk about that rather than just Tinder. Like, you should be more prepared, but it is very much like dating. Like, you're likely to find a partner if you do go to the dates and you're prepared and you have good conversation points planned and you know who you are and you strongly believe in what you have to offer. But I think you should do the prep work, whereas Tinder is much more go or no go. Yeah.
Yeah. Match.com.
But Tinder from a numbers game perspective, right? I would assume there's like quantity leads to quality in a way here. But I think you're more likely to get through and further with a smaller, less known VCs than opposed to like the name brand that everyone is going for, because they are like more picky. But you want the smaller ones that have more to prove.
Mm. Okay. I have two last questions. Raise more than what you need. Would you say it's a good advice or not?
Yeah, but also just wanted to add, say you're raising less and raise more than what you're saying you're going to raise, and raise more than what you need.
I want to counter this a little bit. I think if you can raise more, that's great. But I think that one advice that I would give anyone, including myself, is hire slowly. Because after every fundraise, round of funding, you have this pressure to hire talent usually. And even when you're conscious about like, well, I will not fall for this time, you still are under pressure to hire more people. Hire talent proves that you can hire. That's one of the expectations. But when you hire too fast, unless you can also let people go fast, which is very painful for many of us, right? And for people, of course, then I recommend to hire as slowly as possible. In my experience, it's almost like never too slow, especially after the round of funding when you feel this pressure. Just like really make sure that this is the right people and you know what you're hiring them for. Because hiring mistakes are painful for everyone and also for your runway, right? For your bottom line.
I would add that if you already have clear product market fit, you have good unit economics, then you like the dilution is probably more worrisome. Like you can leave more on the table from an investment perspective. But if you're at the cusp of potentially spending more time, like everything takes more time, I would take more. So like early on, probably take more than less, because you need time to prove your thesis and get to Series A metrics or whatever the next round metrics is required to be.
Yes. Last question, which I heard from other founders in private conversation, the investors you need, the ones you pick, are, you know, not the ones that, you know, when you're in the honeymoon phase, you have hopes, you build something great, but that will back you in the worst times when you're really struggling. You may not raise in the next round, you're really struggling and they're here for you. I don't know if that's true. I didn't go that far, but we'd love to hear.
So in what I've seen is that, and it goes back to what I said earlier, like the more name brand they are, the less likely they are to roll up their sleeves, because they have other portfolio companies that can be the one, right? but you really want to reference check your investors and ask them for references on companies that didn't work out, right? And how they acted in the worst of times.
This is a very good advice. It's very important to have candid conversations with other founders. And in many situations, other founders were extremely helpful in sharing their experience. And it is a very good idea to have some reference calls with the founders who your investor, potential investors invested in, because you will never know until you work with them. Also, it's important to take into account that relationships between different people develop differently. So, of course, you want to know if there is any particular pattern with your investors, but it's also possible that you might have just better chemistry, better relationship with your investors, or vice versa. So you will never know. It's a human factor. Mm-hmm. And you will not know how this is going to play out. But I would say that, yes, early on, we did not know how our relationships would go because things change and some super engaged people disengage all the time and vice versa. Some people who you didn't expect to do as much work, they sometimes exceed your expectations. So I haven't figured out the way to predict this, even with reference checks and whatnot. You can learn a lot, but you can not know how they're gonna resonate with you and your company and your team over time. So I don't think that there is a crystal ball here. If someone has it, please share.
I just want to add that it's important that it's a two-way street, right? Like, you can't expect just the investor to be the one rolling up their sleeves if things aren't going well. Like, you need to have transparency and bring them on that journey before it's the fan, right?
I think one of the worst things you can do is surprise your investors. And you also learned that the hard way as a founder. But yeah, that will not help. And I think this advice has been great, by the way. I just really wanted to mention that from both sides. Yeah, and I've also found that large funds can be helpful. Very helpful, even because they're kind of sometimes less sensitive. Actually, they have a big portfolio, they have a lot of investments, so they've seen it all as well. They may be a bit more desensitized to your issue and less likely to necessarily help you like hands on, but sometimes they have a broader perspective, and that can also be very helpful.
Oh, very good learnings. I'm sure there's a lot to cover. It could be a whole series of hours of conversation because there's so many little details of, I mean, it's a full-time job. Like that, I can agree with the fundraising. And with that time is not spent building the product. So it's always the dilemma and the compromise. But for today, closing this round, and so there will be more, and you know, we're rooting for you, Julia, for your next rounds. Is there something I should have asked one of you and I didn't ask at last to close the round, and please say it?
I think the importance of co-founders, I think I touched on it, but I would love to know like more about these experiences, because I think one of the decisions you make is your co-founders, and that determines your ability to fundraise, your ability to last through everything. And I think it could be really great to hear about that as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that if there's one thing I would want to do again, if I started fundraising today, it would be, regardless of how far along you are, start asking investors, what do you need to see for this to be an attractive investment? And just start keeping tabs of what that is. Because the more clearly you get to articulate what is missing, the better you know what to prioritize. Not to say that you should only prioritize what the VCs are telling you, but if you are depending on their money, it's also a great way to show that you're making progress by returning to them once you've reached that stage. And I would just emphasize it's never too late to ask that question, because things always take time and your round will usually take longer than you thought.
I also wanted to highlight that as a fundraising CEO, especially, that is a big part of your job. I think people think I'll fundraise and then I'll do X. It's always be fundraising. You don't really realize that people told me it was a full-time job. And I'm like, it's going to be calls. I do calls all the time. No, it takes a lot of work when you're doing it as a full-time job. It takes much longer than you think. And it is like a full sales process. You're going to have a spreadsheet with what they told you, what the fund is, what they said, when you're going to follow up, what they you promised to send them. And that's also going to be in 2 days, by the way, because you can't wait longer than that. It's definitely fundraising is a big part of VC funded startup CEO's job. And if you don't want to do that, then you don't want a VC capital. I just wanted to emphasize that you need to find a different way because that is the life you're committing to.
Very good reminder. All right, let's close that round. Thanks a lot for sharing your learning wisdom and wait to hear more about the future journey. I know exciting coming ahead for you, Ioana and Aurora. So we'll follow that closely. And Julia, we're rooting for you for that round B. Yay.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It matters a lot.
Thank you.
See you all.
Thanks for listening to this latest episode of Horizon Play podcast. I am growing a community of conscious leaders across the industry and beyond. If you want to join this movement, please share the podcast with other conscious leaders because we have so much more we can learn from each other. If you've enjoyed this episode, please follow and rate the show on Spotify or your other favorite podcast platform. It will help other growing leaders to discover the show and benefit from the valuable insights. If you would like to grow rapidly your leadership skills, you can find more insights on raiseandplay.io, where you will also find my free masterclass on conscious leadership and other resources that I offer. Have a great week, and remember to take care of yourself. Until the next time,